So welcome to Virtual Machines. This is class number 5. Yes. That's fine. Not a problem. So last week we talked about creating some virtual machines. We created Windows and Linux machines within our Hyper-V environment. Today we're going to spend some time creating them within vSphere so that you can see how VMware does it, how it's different in VMware. I'm going to go through the process at the end of our lecture here of installing an ESXi client on a host machine. I'm going to show you that process, and then I'll give you the opportunity at the end to build some virtual machines in that environment. Any questions on anything that we've talked about so far? Everybody still in a good place? Okay. So Chapter 7, again, starts talking more in depth about CPUs for a machine. So we've talked about this a little bit before. And again, basically, the only thing that we can control is the number of CPUs in the machine. But not all machine CPUs are created the same. So different versions of hypervisors are going to handle CPU resources differently, and you have some choices that you need to make before you implement your virtual environment. So again, a virtual CPU is just a slice of a physical CPU. So when we talk virtual CPU, we think of them as actual CPUs, but they're not. They're just portions of time taken away from a physical CPU. Again, CPUs don't tend to be the issue that's in conflict most often. There's usually more than enough CPU power to go around and host all of your virtual machines fine. So CPUs use instruction set and data to perform calculations. CPU performance is a measure of the work being done rather than instructions per se. So when we go to slice time up on a CPU, again, the virtual machine has a guest operating system installed. The guest operating system is going to have processes running on it. The processes that are running in the guest operating system require time on the CPU in order to process. So what they do is they ask the hypervisor, and the hypervisor talks to the host CPU hardware and asks for time for its calculations. So virtualizing the CPU on a hypervisor is actually just scheduling those slices of time on a physical CPU. So one virtual CPU is one physical core, though virtual CPUs are not mapped to physical cores, right? So when we talk cores, again, we talk cores and we talk processors. So the number of processors in a single core machine is one. If we say it's a dual core machine, it has two cores, so it has two. If it's a quad core, it has four cores, so it has four. Pretty straightforward, right? So then we also talk sockets. Again, it can have more than one processor. It can have two sockets. If it has two sockets, each has two cores, then it's going to have four total CPUs, right? If it has two sockets, and each socket has four cores, it's going to have eight total cores. If we talk four sockets, a single core, it's going to have four CPUs. Four sockets, dual core, eight CPUs. Four sockets, four cores, 16 CPUs. We have eight processors, and each processor is that quad core. We have 32 total processors that we can use. Again, that's physical processors. So when we talk virtual CPUs, we can use slices of time on those physical processors. Again, if we're doing a consolidation ratio of something like 10 to 1, that means we have 320 processors that we can assign out to machines. Right? Again, CPU doesn't tend to be the resource that's most in conflict. So again, when we go to configure it, we select the number of cores and the number of sockets that we want. Again, if we select a socket number of 2, then we have to assign cores by 2s. So if we want to assign 3 CPUs to our machine, the only way we can do it is to do it by 3 sockets, right? If we do 2 sockets and 2 cores, we're automatically going to have 4. You can't assign different sockets, different CPU amounts. So just be aware of that. And again, you have to be aware of the guest operating system that you're installing. So different versions of operating systems support a maximum number of CPUs. Again, in a physical environment, we tend not to get that many CPUs in our system, so it doesn't have to worry about it. Again, if we had 32 processors in our system, what operating system is going to handle that, right? So you have to look at that operating system and what it handles. Again, we want to take the minimalist approach. We don't want to immediately go in and assign 32 CPUs to Windows Server 2012 just because it's fun, right? It's not going to use 31 of them most of the time. It's only going to use one. So typically when you go to assign CPUs, typically you use just a single core and then see the performance on the machine. Again, if you know that the machine's going to be a workhorse, it's going to be doing a lot of computational power, maybe you assign it two from the start. But again, you don't want to over-assign the CPUs, because if you have to take them away, the operating systems don't play as nice. They get natty. When you go out and you talk to vendors and vendors offer you their software, again, we talked about the OVF format and how vendors can supply their software in OVF or OVA format to allow you to import to your hypervisor. Usually the software vendor will tell you that you have to reserve CPU for their machine. Reserving CPU for the machine means that you're actually assigning a physical CPU core to that machine. That means that anybody else in the system can't use that physical core on the machine because you have it tied to your virtual machine. It's reserved. The downside of that is, again, no other machine can use that CPU. If the machine that you physically reserved it for is not using that CPU, it's sitting idle, right? It's not doing anything. So we've lost some of that performance gain that we get by virtualizing our environment. Again, the key to virtualization is the pooled resources. People aren't going to be using the CPU all the time, so we allow other machines to use it when we're not using it. People aren't going to be using all of our memory all of the time, so we're going to allow our other virtual machines to use that memory. We're going to have a shared pool of resources. The more reservations that you make, the more you take away from that pooled resource, the less resources that are available to our system. Again, they'll tell you the only way it will work is if you reserve this amount of CPU, this amount of RAM. You say, okay, thank you, and then do it the way that you're supposed to do it in a virtualized environment. The caveat to that is you need to call them for support. The first thing they're going to do is say, well, you haven't made the reservations that we told you you needed to make, and that's why the machine's not working the way that it should. So maybe you go in and put a temporary reservation in. Still doesn't work, doesn't fix your issue. So then you call their support and say, we did everything you told us to do, and now it still doesn't work. But you got to make sure you do your homework before you make that call, because you don't want them calling you an idiot. Especially when that's not going to fix the problem, right? There's plenty of resources in your virtual environment. That isn't the problem. Making that reservation is just detracting from the total performance of your virtual operating system. But it makes the software vendors happy. And again, if you followed all of the software vendors' recommendations for reserving things, basically, what you're doing is breaking up your virtual environment and making physical boxes for each one of these devices, right? It's no longer shared resources. You're not virtualizing. You're making software platform dependent. The opposite of virtualization. Again, follow vendor recommendations, but understand what they mean and how it works. Again, we're going to have our consolidation ratio. It's going to be better than 1-to-1. So again, we're going to be able to assign more virtual CPUs than physical CPUs. With the machines now, we talk about, again, multi-core processors, multiple core processors, and how to get the most resources out of it. Again, I said it's the best to configure just one virtual CPU, see the performance of the machine. Again, each hypervisor is going to show you the performance of the machine. It's going to show you how much resources it's using, how often it's using those. You get these nice little pretty graphs that show you over time the usage of the machine. So you can go back a week, you can go back a day, you can go back a month if your machine's been on that long, and see what the CPU ratio is at. If the CPU ratio is at 80%, but it never goes above 80%, you have an optimal level for your CPU usage, right? If your CPU ever hits 100%, could be an issue. If your CPU hits 100% every Tuesday night and then comes down from it, it's installing Windows updates. That's okay. It's using the most to install it, but then it immediately comes down. So its normal operation process is never spiking up the CPU. It just happens to be that unique situation that occurs every Tuesday night with Windows, right? That it's installing updates. Is it an issue? Maybe you kick in another CPU, see how the performance works out, see if it still spikes at 100%. Chances are, even if you give it 32 CPUs, it's still going to spike to 100% when it installs those Windows updates. And again, it's going to be for that moment in time, and then it's all going to come back to normal. So really, is there a net benefit from assigning 32 versus 1? No, because it's still going to spike. You're still going to have the same level of performance in your everyday operation of your virtual machine. So again, it's best to take that minimalized approach. So there's two different main vendors for CPUs out there. What are the two main vendors of CPUs?
Intel and AMD.
Intel and AMD. Which one's better?
Ford or Chevy.
Right? So opinions are like something, and everybody has one, and they all stink, right? So again, it depends. So again, something that somebody looks at is benchmarks. And again, there was two students having this conversation, and myself and somebody else were trying to drag into this conversation about the performance of Intel versus AMD. So benchmarks is one of the things that Intel does best, right? CPU performance benchmarks, Intel's always going to be AMD, hands down. Why is that? Because benchmarks are tested on instruction sets and how fast you can process instruction sets, and AMD does that, or rather, Intel does that better than AMD every day. Now, long-term performance, it depends on what your system's running. Again, we're talking hypervisors here, we're talking virtual machines, we're talking business infrastructure. How many people do you know of that says, oh yeah, I just installed the latest version of whatever multiplayer online game on my virtual machine because it runs awesome, right? No, you have a gamer rig that's specifically designed to run your games. Virtualization isn't going to make your games better, right? It makes business applications faster. It makes it easier to share file information across. It does database operations. So again, which chipset is best for that? It depends. What type of operations are you doing? So Intel, as a part of its architecture, has something called hyperthreading. So what does hyperthreading do? Does anybody know? Yeah, so it increases the speed in which instructions are loaded and processed in the CPU. So basically what it does is it front loads the second instruction. So the way that a CPU works is that it takes one instruction and it performs that operation. Again, time division multiplexing. We can only do one thing at a time. So we're doing our one thing right now. Well, we used to have to go out and find the next item and load that in. So what hyperthreading does is it gets that second instruction set all ready to run. So while your focus is here, it starts getting that second one all ready to go. And as soon as the first one's done, it switches over to the second one. So in effect, they tell you hyperthreading doubles the amount of cores in your processor. Right? It says for every one instruction, I can do it twice as fast. So what kind of performance gain do you get from hyperthreading? It's two times as fast, right? No, it's about 30% faster. Again, there's a lot of overhead that goes with loading instructions into the CPU register, a lot of overhead that goes from moving from one instruction set to another. That's all handled in that percentage gain. So AMD doesn't have hyperthreading. AMD has what they call simultaneous multithreading, SMT. Yeah, it does the same thing. No, it doesn't. But again, again, if I'm buying a gamer rig, am I going to buy an Intel or am I going to buy an AMD? Most of my gamer friends say AMD hands down. So, again, it depends on what you're doing, what you're trying to do, and how you're doing it. So the problem with Intel and the reason that AMD can beat Intel in certain spots is Intel's backwards compatibility. So the instruction set in the CPU for Intel is very, very complex. There's a lot of different layers because Intel's claim to fame is backwards compatibility. Something that ran in Windows 3.1 should be able to run on my backwards compatible Intel chip, right? Intel's starting to move away from that. Again, we've made our mark. People are buying Intel chips. We no longer have to support our backwards compatibility. AMD's always moved away from it. The instruction sets from AMD, very thin, very, very fast. And again, they changed their processor. That's why you used to have those different versions. Oh, if you have Intel, you need to download this. If you have AMD, you need to download this. But now everything's starting to come together. The instructions are more high level. The languages are more high level. They're abstracting away from the hardware, especially in a virtual environment. We're abstracting away all that hardware information. It doesn't matter what we have under the hood. So if I'm going to buy my machines for a virtual environment, I have to make the choice. Do I go Intel or do I go AMD? Which do I pick? Again, it doesn't matter, right? I can pick Intel, I can pick AMD. What I don't want to do is have a mix. Mixes cause issues. So if I have a virtual environment in place and I'm upgrading my servers, normally I'm better off staying with the same chipset. And again, generations of chipsets are also going to cause issues. So if we have a first generation Intel chip and we have a third generation Intel chip, the instruction sets are different. The way that it goes from one machine to another doesn't necessarily flow. Our hypervisor is going to take care of that for us. What does it mean if I'm going from one type of architecture to another? In a virtual environment, if I have the same architectures, I don't really need to do much. I just need to change my pointers. So, one virtual machine going over to another virtual machine, one virtual machine sitting on a host, migrating to another host, can be done in real time without loss of the machine, as long as the instruction sets are the same. If I'm going from Intel to AMD, the virtual machine can move it over, but it can't do it while the machine is running. So it actually has to turn off the machine and turn the machine back on. So you get a downtime. So my business maybe sends out emails. I have an email server. So my email server goes off for 30 seconds while it migrates machines. Is that a big deal? Maybe, maybe not. Amazon. Amazon goes offline every time it switches for 30 seconds. How much money do you think they're losing in that 30 seconds of downtime? More money than I will make in my lifetime. That's the answer to that. In 30 seconds, just say. So again, depending on your business environment, depending on what you're trying to do, depending on the fault tolerance, depending on how you want to handle it. So again, the easiest thing to do when converting from a non-virtualized environment to converting to a virtualized environment is to use your existing hardware. Again, your existing hardware may be a mixed boat of what you have in your systems, right? You may have one that runs Intel, you may have one that runs AMD, and they may not talk back and forth. Again, that doesn't stop you from creating a virtualized environment. You can create a virtualized environment. The virtual machines can migrate from an Intel host to an AMD host fine, but they need to be turned off in order to do that. And again, is that a big deal? Maybe, maybe not. If it is a big deal, you can tell it not to migrate, so you can keep your machines on their device-specific information. But the problem with that is if you lose that machine, now you've lost that service as well. So you give some to gain some. hypervisors can use hyperthreading. Again, in order to use hyperthreading, the operating systems that you install on your guest operating systems have to be able to use hyperthreading, and all of the machines in the environment have to support hyperthreading. We talked about that. Any questions on any of that? Yes.
One question, but essentially to be a good network administrator, you would just know what each machine is running, like, in terms of AMP and Intel, to know that there's going to be potential hiccups and stuff.
Right. So before you go and install your virtualized environment, you're going to do a lot of research. You're going to research hypervisors. So again, we've started talking about hypervisors here. I've had you write short papers on hypervisors, what they can do, what they can support. So again, Hyper-V with Microsoft, they're a lot more lenient in the hardware that they support. So you can install Hyper-V on almost any server that can run Windows. VMware is more strict. VMware has a hardware compatibility list. If the machine doesn't have the hardware that's on the hardware compatibility list, it won't work in a virtualized environment. There are some caveats. You can try to update drivers. You can try to push Vim updates into VMware. They work sometimes. But for the most part, if you're in a production environment with a business, you're not going to run a VMware environment on non-HCL hardware. And again, that's because if you call VMware and says, hey, this doesn't work, they look down their list and say, yeah, it's not on my list of hardware compatibilities. It's not going to work. Tough nuggies. That's why we published this list. This list says we've tested it, we know that it works, we support it. Otherwise, we don't. And again, VMware, you're going to pay software license fees. So if you're paying $6,000 a year to use VMware, you're going to make sure you have the hardware to run it before you purchase it, right? Hopefully. Hindsight can kill you in budgetary means. That makes sense? Okay. So chapter 8 is, again, talking about memory. And again, we said, in terms of memory, there's very little that we can do other than assign memory to it. We're not going to get into looking at any specific memory features that are available within it. It just does it. So what is memory or RAM? So it's really just storage space. It's active file systems. So memory is the workspace for the operating system. It caches data. It keeps things active. It runs very fast. A hypervisor is going to map virtual memory blocks to the physical memory blocks and use addresses, translation tables to keep track of where everything is. These tables are going to be part of the hypervisor's overhead. That's why when you see the amount of available RAM, it's not going to totally equal the amount of RAM that you have in the system because the hypervisor is going to take some. So if memory is very fast, why isn't everything run in memory? It's temporary, but why is it temporary? So if I have something stored on my disk, it's temporary as well, right? It reads and writes to my disk. I can take it off. I can put it back on. It uses the same kind of pointers. So why don't we use RAM for everything? Why do we have hard disk drives? You gotta speak louder. I can't hear you. So why are we front-loading information? Why don't we just load everything into the memory? Why don't we use RAM for everything? Why do we need disk drives? They can't hold that. They can. RAM can hold as much as you have space for RAM. Get 128 gigs of RAM, you can hold 128 gigs of data. Why do we have disk drives? It's gone when you turn off the machine. It doesn't have to be. It's designed that way for specific reasons, so that we can load more information faster. But why isn't everything in RAM? Why doesn't everybody have 128 gigs of RAM in all of their computers? So it doesn't really slow down the process speed, and in fact, it helps the processor speed the more RAM that you have. Because of cost, it's very expensive. Memory is very expensive, right? RAM is the most expensive thing that you can buy, right?
Wow.
As in terms of storage space. In terms of storage. Yes, and what is a solid-state drive? It's effectively long-term storage for a RAM, right? So that's where solid-state drives came about. They're solid, non-moving memory that we can write to, and it saves after we turn our computer on. It's effectively RAM, but they're expensive. That's why. Right? So on our CPU, we have cache, which is memory. Again, cache is going to load the instruction sets into our CPU. Then we have RAM, which loads it into our cache on our CPU. And then from RAM, we can also save to our disk system, whether it be a solid-state drive or whether it be a spinning disk system for long-term storage. And again, the slower the memory, the cheaper it is, right? So you can get spinning disks at 7,200 RPMs. A terabyte now is what, $38, $37, maybe even cheaper. The last time I looked, it was $39 for a terabyte on a spinning disk. Right? Again, solid state drives more expensive, faster read speeds, faster write speeds, better performance. They've done some crazy things with some hybrids. Right? So you get some spinning disk, but not really, kind of. Again, they try to reduce the cost, give you as much space as possible to store your information. So again, we talk about it like this. So we have stuff in disk. We boot up our computer. It loads that information from our disk into our memory. From our memory, it loads it into cache. From the cache, it loads it into the CPU. The CPU processes the instructions. It goes down to cache, to memory, to disk, back and forth. So again, when we do this, when we start writing things out, that's what's called paging. So it writes a page file. So if you look on your computer, any version of Windows has what's called a page file. Does Linux use a paging file system or no?
No.
Swap space, same idea. So it's got disk space that it's using for your RAM. So by default, Windows creates its own page file size. And that page file size is based on the amount of memory that you have in your computer. So if you look at the page file system that you have going here, that page file is huge because each one of these computers has 32 gigs of RAM, right? So it's designing its page file to be larger than 32 gigs of RAM. So when you see the available space on your disk, it shows you a lot less available than you actually have. So if you buy a terabyte system, it shows a good chunk of that taken out to the page file system. It's there, technically you can write to it, but if you start getting close to the edge of your maximum disk space, the performance goes way down, right? Because it can't write to that swap space, it can't write to that page file, it's running out of space. Paging involves disk input and output, so it's slow, right? Again, we can make it faster by installing solid state drives, things of that nature, but it still has to read and write. So your SATA dictates how fast you can read and write to those drives. Again, RAM is going to be the resource that you're going to have the most contention with in your system. Right? It's going to be the resource you're going to run out of first. So if you have 80 machines that are all running Windows, it works fine with 8 CPUs. But many times, 16 times 8, or 16 times 80, gigs of RAM. Now you're going to start running into some problems. Again, when we go to create our virtual machine, we choose what operating system we're going to be installed for the container. Again, the only thing that does when we choose it within VMware or we choose it within Hyper-V is that it gives us a suggestion of how much disk space, how much RAM that we're going to assign to our machine. So if we say Windows 7, it'll say we need at least 1 gig of RAM. The maximum that we can take is X amount. We recommend at most 3 gigs. Install at your will. Right? So then you choose what you're going to set for the machine. Now, if I go and I power that machine on and then I install something like Debian, it doesn't matter, right? This is just a label and just a suggestion. The machine's going to get whatever resources I've allocated to it. So I can call it Windows 7, but whatever I install on the guest operating system is the guest operating system that's going to. Again, I can add memory in without turning the machine off. That's called hot add. Most operating systems support it without giving you a headache. Some don't. Again, some services that run in operating systems won't recognize the memory change until you stop those services and restart them or reboot. But if you're going to take memory away from a system, then you always have to reboot. Usually you can't even configure to take the memory off until the machine's powered off. Hyper-V and VMware both block you from actually removing resources until the machine's powered off. Again, there's overhead for the memory, so again, the hypervisor is going to keep track of all the tables, keep track of who's using what where. Again, in a perfect world, we talk about contiguous memory. Contiguous memory is memory that's taken from a long line of addresses that's all in the same spot. In terms of RAM, we tend not to use contiguous memory. Contiguous memory, again, all in the same spot, so we have to actually grab whatever pieces of memory we can at whatever time. So if we need 8 gigs, we go in and we find the spot where 8 gigs are, we point the memory address to that. When we give it back, that may be in the middle of somebody else using it, but there's no sort of defragmentation option which is going to make that memory contiguous. It's just going to keep track of the memory addresses that it knows and the overhead with that. Does that make sense? So again, in most systems now, especially if you have an SSD drive, you don't want to have disk defragmentation on. Because what disk defragmentation does is it moves memory allocation space. And in terms of an SSD drive, you can only read and write so many times to a sector, and it kills it. Again, spinning disks have the same problem, but there's a lot more read and writes on a spinning disk than on SSD. So if you have an SSD drive, turn off disk defragmentation before your disk dies. They call that mean time to failure. Your MTF is a lot higher on your SSDs. Again, the better the hypervisor is, the less overhead that it has keeping track of all this. And there's other tools that we can install to help us out. So again, we talked a little bit about VMware tools. VMware tools actually helps with what's called memory ballooning. So memory ballooning means that it's going to take the information that's written to the guest operating system's RAM and actually flush it out to disk. So again, I have my machine. I just turned my machine on. I'm running my machine for a long time. It takes up. It starts filling up. Now my RAM's full, so I'm using the full 32 gigs of RAM that I have assigned to that machine. Now I stop using that machine. Well, that RAM's still full, right? It still has all of the addresses, all the stack pointers kept live, so it knows where everything is and everything's running. So if I come back to that machine, it's in the same state that I left it. Well, the hypervisor can see that this machine's not getting used, that it's just sitting there idle. So it says somebody else needs the RAM that that machine has. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that from active memory, and I'm going to flush it out and put it on disk. So if they ever come back to use it, it's fine. It's still there. I still have all the same information. It's just written out to my slower device. So in terms of performance, if I'm using a virtual machine and then I get flushed out to page file, I may see a decrease in speed. So I double click on something and then it takes an extra second for it to start up. Again, this happens in normal Windows as well. So users are already trained to be patient, right? Nobody yells and screams at their keyboard or their computer if it's not going fast enough, right? Ever. But again, it's expected operation, especially in Windows, that sometimes it takes a little bit longer to do things than we expect. But again, this is how we can facilitate our memory overcommitment. So again, this allows us to use more virtual RAM than physical RAM that we have on our system. Again, this ballooning is only going to take place when there's contention. And contention, again, is when more than one virtual machine is trying to allocate to the same resource. Right? So if I have 32 gigs of RAM, and I have two virtual machines that each have 8 gigs of RAM, this is never going to happen because I've only hit 16 gigs of RAM and I have 32 in my system. So there's never going to be any contention. Now I've installed 80 and I have 160 gigs of RAM, but each one of them is trying to use 4 gigs of RAM, so now there's contention. They're fighting over the RAM. So this is how it resolves those issues and allows the RAM to be used by multiple systems. And again, we have our physical memory. In an ideal world, we're going to use contiguous memory. That's memory that's all in the same order. In a real world environment, we're not going to do that. We're just going to grab whatever space we can and allocate to it. So if I was going to take a machine and I was going to allocate, say, 4 gigs of RAM in each one of these machines, or sorry, 16 gigs of RAM in each one of these is allocating 8. If I tried to grab this memory space here between these two virtual machines, there may not be enough to allocate there. So it's going to move it down and not be where I expect it. Again, the hypervisor is going to take care of all of this for us, so we don't need to concern ourselves where it's writing to the physical memory on our host, unless we have an issue with the physical RAM that's on our host. So the way that would present itself is, every time I run a machine, it runs fine. Then all of a sudden I get a blue screen of death, right? Why did I get a random blue screen of death on this machine? Then that machine runs fine for years, but the next machine over blue screens of death the next day, right? It seems really random, really obscure, and you can't find anything that points to it. It could be that you have a bad RAM chip in your host, right? So in a real-world environment, you probably have more than one host. It runs fine on all the other hosts, but this one host is where it crashes every day. So now you have something to kind of troubleshoot from, an area to start from. There's something wrong with this particular host. In terms of Windows, you can also do page file sharing. So again, I said I had 80 versions of Windows. If those 80 versions of Windows are all doing the same thing, they can share a page file. So again, Windows runs a lot of operations in the background. A lot of them are all the same. It can share that page file information. When it shares that information and only has to keep one copy of that information, that's called deduplication, data deduplication. So it's only going to keep the changes between the operating systems, and everything else that it has in common, it's going to share. That can cause problems, especially with performance, because if something changes, then all of a sudden the change file starts to get larger and larger and larger, right? Windows Server 2012 R2 supports deduplication of its file system, so we'll help it do it automatically. There's other storage mediums out there that help support data deduplication to reclaim physical memory and virtual memory. And you can reclaim up to 10 to 40% of that RAM. Again, you may have some performance issues. Again, they're getting better at removing the issues and increasing the performance. So that's it for the chapter today. Did you have any questions on any of that? Chapter 7, chapter 8? Again, pretty straightforward. So that ends the lecture.